Good afternoon. Welcome to Line One, your health connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. Adolescence is a critical time in the developmental process. Teens are engaged in an exciting exploration of who they are and how they will fit into the world. Sexuality blossoms, peers become the primary influence, and it dawns on them that their parents are not the infallible beings they once believed them to be. This important stage in development is also a time of great risk. Almost half of all teen deaths are accidental. Substance abuse, violence, and other high-risk behaviors put teens at risk for early death and for the development of mental and physical health problems that can follow them into adulthood. In 1995, the state of Alaska began tracking statistics and trends of adolescent high-risk behavior by means of the Youth Risk Behavior Survey. Joining me to discuss the history of the YRBS and the results of the recently completed 2015 survey are Marcia Howell with the Alaska Injury Prevention Center, public health scientist Andrea Finati with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, and Jennifer Baker, who is the Adolescent Health Project Coordinator for the Department of Health and Social Services. I appreciate you all being here to join me today.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I want to take just a moment remind listeners out there how we can be reached. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. And you can always email your questions to line1@alaskapublic.org. You got to spell out line1, L-I-N-E-O-N-E. Please don't be shy about calling in or sending emails, because that'll add some flavor to our show. All right, before we get started with the high-risk behavior and the survey results, can each of you take a few minutes to tell us a little bit about yourselves and how you became involved with the Youth Risk Behavioral Survey? We can, start over here with... go ahead.
Hi, this is Andrea. I came to Alaska about 23 years ago, really to do public health research at the university, and did that for a while, and ended up coming over to the Division of Public Health at the state of Alaska about a little 15 years ago, and ended up working in chronic disease prevention and health promotion, and being the chronic disease epidemiologist. And so having different sources of data that we could use to monitor patterns and trends in chronic diseases and their risk factors was really a critical part of that work. And so the YRBS was one of the surveys that allows us to do that work.
All right. Marcia?
I'm Marcia Howell, the executive director at the Alaska Injury Prevention Center. And I also started doing prevention work about 15 years ago. Prior to that, I did disability law cases for people who had already suffered some kind of traumatic injury or life event, and decided that I would much rather be on the prevention side of the world. And through that, one of the things that we focus on is making sure we're not making decisions on what to do based on our own personal interests, but really what are the problems facing Alaskans, and using YRBS data helps us determine our priorities and what funding to seek.
All right. Jennifer?
Yeah, I have been in Alaska for about 11 and a half years and started working for Division of Public Health in late 2009. Prior to that, I worked in recreational outdoor programs and received my APU bachelor's for recreational therapeutic and outdoor recreation programming. And prior to that, I had some experience in juvenile justice, after school programming, and other outdoor recreational programs. I just really like working with young people, and I've been able to use a lot of that experience in my work with public health and youth engagement and positive youth development at the state of Alaska.
All right, you said you're the Adolescent Health Project Coordinator. What exactly?
One of two.
One of two.
Yes.
So what is that? What's involved in that? The Adolescent Health Project, what is that?
So the Adolescent Health Program really looks at especially uses YRBS every single day.
Okay.
We really look at what is the trends of what's affecting young people in Alaska, as well as talks and works with young people to see how we can develop programming that's effective for them. We also do some funding streams that deal with teen and unintended pregnancy prevention, violence prevention, rape prevention, and education. and the list goes on. We work with a lot of local organizations also to reduce violence, like the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, one of many organizations that help to support young people in their lives.
So a lot of networking.
Yes.
All right, before we get into the results of this year's, or I guess it's 2015's survey, let's talk a little bit about the adolescent brain. I know growing up as a teenager, mine didn't work so well as far as like the decision-making processes. And I was one of those, I guess not all kids are high-risk kids. There's a large percentage of kids that go along and they take pretty moderate risks and their risks are pretty safe. But there does seem to be a large number of a high percentage of young people and adolescents that engage in behavior that makes us as adults kind of scratch our head and go, well, what were they thinking? So what is different about the adolescent mind, and what's what drives that risk behavior?
Can I go back to that question about what you were you thinking? I think
yes.
That a lot of young people really get confused by that, because it's not what they were thinking, it's what they were feeling, because they're mostly driven by their amygdala, which is basically an almond-shaped thing that basically just drives your emotions, amongst other things. And the prefrontal cortex, the front of your brain, which is what a lot of adults have developed, that kind of drives your coordination, your thinking, your thoughts of consequences. So when a parent goes, what were you thinking? They're like, I was feeling my way through it. So maybe that's a good question to start with parents, is when you're looking at the emotional brain or the teen brain in general, that development happens through age like 25 and beyond. So really when we think about adolescent development, it's a lifelong process. I like to think about it like a backpack. So when young people have, when you have a little youngster and you're about to send them off to school, you pack their bag full of awesome stuff, and it's a Superman backpack or something. You put it on them, send it to school. And a little bit later, they bring the backpack home, they empty it out, and they fill it with the skills and behaviors and identities and feelings, values and relationships that they think are important. And then they go back to school. And then later on, they dump it all out on the floor again during this pruning process that your brain does. And then they put patches on it, and then they dye their hair, and then they put all the stuff back in the backpack that they think are important, some of those of which were the skills and stuff that you gave them. And then they go on with the rest of their lives. And by age 30, they're a completely different person than they originally were. So I think that parents can read into subtleties when it comes to emotion, but young people don't necessarily look at those subtleties, and they can become reactive. And so that's where some challenges come into play with the parent and adult relationship, or parent and youth relationship. Can we talk a little bit more about normal risk-taking versus high-risk behavior or high-risk-taking?
Absolutely, because I think it's an important distinction, because, as we said, the adolescent brain is sort of, evolution shows us, or, you know, if risk-taking was not advantageous as a species, it would have been wiped out. So there must be some advantage. So
right.
What is normal, you know, I hate to use that word, but typical risk taking versus extreme risk taking and high risk behavior? That'd be great.
Okay, so when you look at the adolescent brain, it's driven, or I want to say driven because it kind of leads into a metaphor. So it's driven to take risks. So basically, like we talked about earlier, the gas pedal, which is like your decision making based on no understanding of consequence, versus your brakes. So your gas pedal develops way before your brakes do. And so as the brakes develop more, you'll see an increase in ability to plan, remember more, to be organized, and even have mood regulation. So high-risk behavior is differentiated by continually acting without care of personal safety and lack of involvement in positive things that you once used to do. So that actually might be a significant warning sign for depression, mental health challenges, and potential for suicide. So those high-risk behaviors are basically a long-term, continually taking risks, even understanding consequences or being able to experience those consequences and still making really high-risky decisions, like driving under the influence, continually having sex without protection, without condoms or contraceptives, really doing things that are going to cause risk or long-term harm to the person. And to kind of complicate risk a little bit, too, you have trauma. So there's this film out called Paper Tigers. I don't know if you've heard of it.
I have, but I haven't seen it.
Okay. So it's this really great story about Lincoln High School and they notice that a lot of their young people are experiencing and participating in high-risk behavior, lots of drug use, lots of driving decisions, lots of sex without condoms decisions. And these are actually resulting in some pretty significant problems for these young people, and they're trying to determine why this is happening. A lot of these young people have experienced significant trauma in their lives at home, and then they're coming to school and acting out. And so they're really, they try to take a different approach to it. And we know that when you experience trauma in many forms, you tend to numb out. And whether that numbing out is using substances or, you know, having unprotected sex or driving while intoxicated, however people are numbing out, some people even numb out through cutting. So I think that with adolescence is problematic because not only is the brain developing these essential abilities to cope while your brain is developing, with stress, it starts to hardwire these mechanisms through a process we call myelination. And that long-term resilience that they might lack, or that long-term hard wiring of really bad coping skills or not so great coping skills, ends up repeating itself later into adulthood. So this, like, is a great film for parents and teachers and young people to watch because it really gives them a significant idea of how things can be improved by just changing a little thing. Like, we'll talk a little bit later about protective factors, you know, having an adult that cares about you in your life aside from your parents, having three or more adults that are significant in your life that are outside the school system, participating in volunteering, just knowing that you matter in your community are things that are super important to help reduce, or like you said earlier, mitigate some of that risk. So, and that kind of goes along with ACEs too. We've talked a lot about adverse childhood experiences in the past on your show through historical trauma. And knowing that those pieces are, yes, young people can experience recurrent physical abuse or emotional abuse, but we know that there can be that level of resilience, that young people can establish that resilience and still move forward and not be subject to later on morbidity and mortality because of ACEs. There is a huge opportunity with an adolescent brain to become resilient and to become a perfectly functioning, quote unquote, you know, normal human being. So I think that that's the positive of the adolescent brain, is it's very resilient.
So yeah, what I hear you saying and what plays out in my office and in the offices of therapists, my peers and coworkers, is that kids who have the more significant the adverse childhood experiences, the more risk factors they have for developing mental health problems, and the more mental health problems, and it's particularly depression and anxiety. Teenagers don't know quite what to do with that or how to process that or how to deal with it, and then they tend to numb out or dissociate is another. I did a show on dissociative disorders, which really is what video games, alcohol, you know, running the streets with your friends, it gets you out of your head. It checks you out from your troubles and your daily woes. And that's what I find, that kids are engaging in high-risk behavior. It's also a great dose of adrenaline and excitement, and it fires off all those endorphins that, that feel pretty good, sex, drugs, rock and roll. So, all right, so with that as the backdrop, I guess it's time to jump in to explain exactly what is the YRBS.
Can I give you a transition piece?
Yeah, absolutely. Go ahead.
Sorry. So in 2012, Dr. Gabriel Garcia did this really amazing study, and he really looked at the respondents, you know, young people's perceptions of associated risk and protective factors. And so he used the YRBS data to compare if youth were more likely to engage in risk factors based on how many protective factors they had. And so youth were less likely to engage in risky behaviors when they reported having at least four protective factors, whereas they were more likely to have A's and B's if they had a caring person in their life, or if they were encouraged by teachers, or if they had parents to talk to them at school every day. If they had parents that talked to them about school every day, if they were volunteering or helping three or more hours in their community, or if they were involved in school activities. So some of those things I think are really important to mention, because that's absolute use of YRBS data to help us do our programming in the state of Alaska.
All right. For those of you who might be tuning in late, my guests today are Marcia Howell with the Alaska Injury Prevention Center, public health scientist Andrea Finotti, and Adolescent Health Project Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, or one of them, Jennifer Baker. Today we're discussing high-risk behavior in teens and the results of the 2015 Youth Risk Behavior Survey, which we're going to jump into right now. So who wants to tackle? Andrea, why don't you go ahead and explain to us exactly what is the YRBS? What do people need to know about it? What is it?
Sure. The YRBS is a school-based survey that's done. It's done across the country, but here in Alaska it's done of high school students, so grades 9 through 12. And it asks a series of questions about behaviors, and really what we're trying to get at is level of risk for things that we know that are related to health outcomes. The survey asks around behaviors in about six categories. It looks at tobacco use, alcohol use and other drug use, sexual behaviors, behaviors related to unintentional injury and violence, and inadequate physical activity and nutrition behaviors as well. And there's some additional items too, but those are the main six categories. So yes, it's part of a national surveillance system. It's coordinated with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and we at the Department of Health and Social Services administer it in coordination with the Department of Education and Early Development, and of course with the schools and the school districts.
So whose idea was it, and not necessarily who, but why did this come to be? What was the motivation behind it?
It came out of CDC and developed in 1990, and they were really interested in putting in place a surveillance system that would allow people to monitor and look at the behaviors that were really related to the leading causes of morbidity and mortality in young people in the United States. And so that was really the genesis.
Okay, so explain, how is this test administered? How does it get... Yeah, I know it's given in the schools, but give us a little, Andrea, this is yours. Give us a little bit of a background, or how it's given in the schools. How do parents become aware of it? Do you have to get parental permission? But where do kids take this?
Sure. So it's classroom-based. So the high school students are taking it in their classrooms, and it's a multi-stage sampling, which means that we first get a sample of schools across the state. It's a statewide survey. And then within those schools, we get a survey of classrooms. So we really want to get as representative a sampling of students as we can. So if you happened to be a student sitting in one of those classrooms, the proctor, which is the teacher of that class or someone else at that school, would administer the survey. It's confidential. We don't collect names of students. It is completely voluntary. If at any point along the way a student doesn't want to take it, they don't have to take it. If they want to take it and they don't want to answer a particular question, that's absolutely fine. And absolutely, parental permission is required for it. What's called active parental permission.
Okay.
So, yeah.
Active versus?
Versus passive.
Passive.
So opt-in versus opt-out. Yes.
Right. Okay. So parents have to sign a permission slip.
Yeah. And that can be done. More school districts are moving to online registration, and often saying yes or no to these types of surveys happens at that time. So some in the old days, it would be a piece of paper and often would end up at the bottom of a kid's backpack and may not get brought back. A lot of schools are moving to now do the online registration. So that's how we get the permissions.
I think I have some of those permission slips on the floor of my car. So do you get a lot of pushback from parents, or what's the level of participation? Are people pretty anxious to participate in this? Because it seems like a really good thing, like sort of a no-brainer. Or do people not necessarily trust that it's really anonymous, or that it's going to be used for other things?
Well, certainly the clearer we can be about all the value of the data and how it is voluntary and confidential, I think that enhances those things. We do get a majority of permissions, so that's a good thing. It is challenging. We are one of Alaska, this last time around, was one of only four states that has active parental permission. And it's it's universally more difficult to deal with that than when you had passive permissions. And we were the only state this last time that got the response level that we need to obtain weighted data compared to the other states.
Can you tell us what weighted data is?
Sure. So the survey is done with a sample. Okay. Ultimately, I think, get about 5% of enrolled students statewide. Mm-hmm. And that's done in a way that we believe we get representative students. But it's still not all the students. And so you can weight up to enrollment by looking at the sex and the race and the grade level that the students are in to make sure it's representative of the actual statewide enrollment.
And it's done 9 through 12?
9 through 12th grade, yes.
Okay, with equal representation from each.
That's right.
Each grade. All right. So I guess we got through several of those questions that I had. What is the, are you getting, you mentioned that you're getting participation from all over the state. So that includes the rural schools.
And, absolutely.
What about some of the alternative education schools? Is that represented in the data?
That's a really good question. So the YRBS is really a series of surveys, one that we call the traditional survey, which is what some of the results that we'll be talking about today come from, are just your most of what people would think of as a high school in the state. Then there's a separate survey done of alternative schools, which are done, the Department of Education or Early Development defines these as schools that really benefit students who may be at high risk and really will benefit from those alternative learning settings. And so that's a separate survey done. An additional survey is of correctional facilities that are high schools. So we collect those data as well.
McLaughlin.
Yes.
I guess there's a couple of others. Mm-hmm. Fairbanks, Ketchikan. Okay. So we gather all this data. We ask all these questions about physical health. I read some of the questions. It's about how much time kids are watching TV, how much time they spend outside exercising. I mean, the list of questions is quite remarkable, and it covers everything from mental health, and you mentioned bullying, and seatbelt use, and smoking cigarettes. And for folks who want to access this, it's a really interesting read. I mean, it doesn't seem like it might not be an interesting read, but it is a really. I went back in time, and I've looked at it for several years over for different shows to get data on trends in Alaska. So, what is this information telling us? What is it telling us about the state of physical and mental health in Alaska?
I think from the injury prevention perspective, and let me say that, so we're interested more in the mental health components and the choices, safe choices, and also substance use. But all the other questions have people who are equally passionate about the data that's provided through YRBS. So I'll only be talking a little bit about what I know, but just know that there are many, many more of me that have different perspectives and issues they're concerned about.
And now, Marcia, you're with the Alaska Injury Prevention Center. So
right.
You're not with the Department of Health and Social Services, or is that?
No, okay. we're a nonprofit.
Okay.
So we are the users of Jenny's information, and we're the users of the YRBS information. And it helps us make decisions on what projects to do, what issues to prioritize, and how to go about it. It also helps us write grants because we can show, look, this is the information we're receiving from youth. You know, it's not like we can just go out and know how many students or high school students are drinking or how many are engaging in any of these other behaviors. So having access to the information through the YRBS gives us, we know that kids are protected when they answer the questions. It's anonymous, and it provides a wonderful source of information for us when we're making decisions. I could tell you about a lot of different types of decisions we're making, but one in particular, most recently, we've been looking at driving for a long time, because like you said, motor vehicle crashes are one of the leading causes of death for youth. And we've been looking at seatbelts for a long time. I mean, some people will say, so YRBS, it's just students saying what they do and don't do. Can you really trust that? And I know Andrea has a better way of describing the reliability and validity piece. What I know is that we also do seatbelt observations. And what the youth report that they're doing and what the observations show us that they're doing are really pretty similar. There's some scenarios that are a little bit different. So it is valuable, maybe not exactly for what's going on, but it's very valuable for watching trends over time. From that, we know that in the last couple of years, using cell phones for texting and email has been a question that was asked. And 35% of students admitted that they use their cell phone for texting or emailing while they're driving. So we thought, okay, well, that's a big issue. And that's way more students that are only about 5 or 6% that are driving while they're drunk. Not to minimize that as a problem.
Right.
But when we're prioritizing, we try to figure out where can we make the biggest impact. And so we took that information to students all over the state, NOATAC, Fairbanks, schools around Anchorage. And the kids came up with ideas about how could they, as peers, influence their peers to not do that, to not use their phone while they're driving, in using what Jenny's saying about, you know, kids are differentiating from their parents, they're separating, and they're creating their own influences on each other. So they came up with some video and some ideas about how to do it. And one was, let's promote, as a passenger, tell the driver not to use their cell phone. And so then they asked questions of each other after they did their little big promotional campaigns. And 98% of students at South High said, yeah, if somebody told me not to text while I'm driving, I'm not going to text while I'm driving. And 82% of students in Fairbanks said, yeah, I'll speak up. So we used YRBS data to determine that using a cell phone while driving is an issue for youth, and they recognize it. We told students, look, this is an issue, and you guys are talking about it. Go make change, and they did.
Texting and driving is a huge issue, and I've read reports that have said it's more dangerous than drinking and driving for teenagers right now, and it's one of the leading causes or contributors to car crashes. So I've come across two accidents with teenagers in the last few years where they were panicked and talking about how I just looked at it for a minute. One girl said, I just looked down for a second. And, you know, I mean, she was obviously very scared and afraid and just kind of spewing. But it's a huge problem. So I think that's an important point in how you're using this data. So how are we using the data? And one of the most effective, as I said in the intro, that peers are the number one influence on other kids. They're much more important than parents at this point. So to drive that it's not cool to text, and to have kids sort of, so you guys are putting some funding into peer programs, it sounds like, at the About Injury Prevention Center.
Right. So that leads to another great thing about YRBS. We're using YRBS data to get funding from Federal Highway Safety to promote programming in Alaska schools. And then that money also trickles down to each student group that participates, gets a chunk of funding for their own student group, which then gives them, promotes protective factors of engaging in school and feeling like they're connected. So It's a wonderful big circle kind of thing.
And I guess it's probably important. Are you generating any programs in elementary schools and middle schools for this same kind of thing? Because early conversations with kids about sex and drugs and texting and driving, and I mean, those are in the earlier. I mean, the research indicates that the earlier you start having these conversations before they have to make these decisions in the moment is fairly critical. So, is there any of that going down into elementary schools?
That's a really good point. And one of the things, and this is a little bit separate from YRBS, but it leads to the healthier behaviors, is like promoting booster seats and car seats or booster seats for younger children. And then it becomes normal to be buckled up. So wearing a seatbelt as you get older is normal. Another is promoting safe bicycling for middle school students who are pre-driving, so that they have a feeling of being of the vulnerability of other road users once they start driving. Maybe, hopefully, little firing of the brain will say, oh yeah, there's a risk. Because often risk is more recognized with youth for risk to somebody else and not to oneself. There's a feeling of invulnerability. And but hurting someone else is a bigger factor for making healthy decisions.
So something like defensive bike riding would translate into defensive driving. All right. So that's one way it's going. So we're already at the halfway point in our show. Let's go ahead and take a short break. I want to remind folks out there that you're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. My guests today are Marcia Howell with the Alaska Injury Prevention Center and public health scientist Andrea Finotti with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. And also joining us is Jennifer Baker, who's one of the Adolescent Health Project coordinators for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services. The focus of today's show is high-risk teen behavior and the findings of the recently completed 2015 Risk Behavior Survey. You can reach us with your questions or comments at 550-8433 or call toll-free at 1-888-353-5752. And you can also email your questions to us at line1@alaskapublic.org. After this short break, we'll continue our discussion about youth risk and the 2015 Alaska YRBS results. I'm Prentice Pemberton.
You're listening to Line One from Alaska Public Media. The program repeats tonight at 8 p.m. on KSKA Anchorage and will not be taking phone calls. You can find Line One on iTunes or listen at alaskapublic.org.
Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on KSK Anchorage. I'm your host, Prentice Pemberton. If you're just tuning in, my guests today are Marcia Howell with the Alaska Injury Prevention Center, public health scientist Andrea Finotti with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, and the Adolescent Health Project Coordinator for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, Jennifer Baker. We are discussing the results of the 2015 Youth Risk Behavior Survey and what this indicates as we'll move forward in the show about the current trends in high-risk behavior. Please remember you can email your questions or comments about today's show to line1@alaskapublic.org. You can call us locally at 550-8433 or reach us on our toll-free number at 1-888-353-5752. Please remember the show repeats tonight at 8. So if you're listening to this Monday evening, you'll be hearing a taped recording and we will not be able to accept your calls. All right, so before we're going to go back to Alaska injury prevention and we wanted to talk, we were talking earlier, Marcia, about, I said accidental deaths were the number one cause of deaths for teenagers, and you kind of pointed out that accidental is not really the correct term. So can you highlight that a little bit and correct me on that one?
Sure. Since you're offering for allowing me to correct you, I will do it. Accidental, what's actually the leading cause of death for youth are injuries. And injuries can be divided up into intentional and unintentional. Unintentional being things like motor vehicle crashes. And we try to use the word crash instead of accident because accident connotes that it's just something you can't prevent. It's just the act of God, or it's something unpreventable. When truly, usually, in a lot of cases, motor vehicle crashes and subsequent injuries and deaths aren't really preventable. And on the other side, the intentional deaths would be suicide, violence-related. And that's a whole other topic, which YRBS has a wealth of information that helps us look at what we can do, what kinds of factors, like Jenny was talking about, protective factors for mental health, mental wellness for youth. So we use a lot of the YRBS data to help us determine how to prevent suicide, intentional deaths, by looking at factors that lead up to it.
That's a really good point, because most car crashes are not really accidents. They are a lack of awareness, a lack of understanding the weather conditions, the road conditions, a lack of defensive driving, not being aware of what's going on around you, or texting, or, and they're not intentional. Nobody would intend to hurt anybody, but they are unintended crashes or they're not accidents. It's easy to go back to that language, and that's probably an important distinction for us to be thinking about. Was when we talk to our teenagers, is that car accidents are often car crashes are often preventable, and by increasing our awareness of what's going on around us, we can greatly reduce those. Now, all right, so. Areas of mental health. When we talk about kids who are sedentary and not getting out of the house and high risk behavior, so what does the YRBS tell us about mental health, depression, or does it measure those sorts of mental health things, or does it more measure the, I don't know, the behaviors that are associated with those?
This is Andrea. I can take that a little bit. It sort of yes and no. It to some extent, there are, as Marcia alluded to, a series of questions that are asked around and maybe leading up to suicide. In fact, one of them assesses if there was at least two weeks where the high school student felt so sad or hopeless that they really couldn't do their normal activities. And so it's essentially an indicator of depression. And unfortunately, that is one of the measures that we saw increase over this last, really over the last 8 years, but and more significantly recently.
Yeah, I was looking at the question is, felt so sad, hopeless daily for 2 weeks in a row, they stopped doing usual activities during the past year. So that indicates that in the last year, did it happen for 2 weeks in a row? And 2007, that number is 26.9, and 2015, it was 33.6. That's a statistically significant increase, I would say, in the wrong, you know, obviously in the wrong direction. So do we know why? I mean, what does that tell us, that we have that information? What does that tell us? Who would like to take that incredibly difficult question? That's a hard one.
I can tell a little bit about what we know, and that's by actually digging a little deeper into the data to determine who are the youth who are feeling this. And as it turns out, girls are much more likely. That's 1 in 3 girls feel that degree of sadness and hopelessness, which is, you know, 1 in 3 is a lot.
That's really.
And for boys,
I have 3 girls. That's, well, you know, devastating. That means one of them.
I have 3 girls, too, and
okay.
Yes. and for boys, it's about 1 in 5. 18% of boys have that, say that they have that same feeling, although boys and girls tend to experience depression and that kind of severity.
Boys are less likely to own that and understand it in that same term, probably. But yeah.
Probably. And so breaking it down into a little bit smaller chunks helps us figure out what to do and how to do what kinds of things to do about it. And one of the things we know about girls is they're more likely to seek help from an adult, and this comes from YRBS too. They're more likely to have at least one adult other than their parents who they feel like they can go to get help. Boys are a little less likely, but still not too bad at 77%. So creating relationships, creating programs, or working with adults to be available for youth in a way that youth will access them is something that we can do based on the information that we've learned to help reduce the feelings of sadness and hopelessness.
All right. So what other, we're talking about trends that are sort of, that's one that obviously is something we should be concerned about. Seriously considered attempting suicide during the past year, I think goes in hand with that. And it went from really 16% in 2013 to 20% in 2015. It remained sort of, well, it kind of went down in 2009, 2011, and then spiked back up. Can we can we chalk that up to statistical variation, or do we think that there's some indication of a problem there that needs to be looked at closer? Andrea, you got?
Well, we test, of course, all of these trends at the different levels. And for the seriously considered attempting suicide during the past year, that was actually a statistically significant increase just between 2013 and 2015. So in terms of significance, yeah, it's there for that one.
And so what do we do with that information? I mean, how do we, again, I guess we look at improving suicide prevention programs in the schools. We look at, I mean, how is this used to direct funding and to make policy decisions?
It's a huge question. I think that the general answer, and Marcia hit on some of this, is one, just putting that spotlight on some of these findings that you had said, wow, can this really be right? And just having that level of awareness is very important. Showing the trends, what is going up, what is going down, what is something that we want to try to get ahead of before it gets worse. Looking at the disparities, whether it's by sex or by grade level or by racial ethnic group, that really gives us more tools in terms of, from a program development perspective, understanding how we're going to attack something, who is the group that really is at highest risk. I think all of those things together and absolutely can drive program development, can drive policy. Partners can advocate for policies. Just an example, 2015 was the first time we asked about e-cigarette use, vaping.
Yeah.
And we expected it would be high from what we've seen elsewhere in the country. It was higher than I think most of us really expected at 18%. And so that brings awareness to an issue and can drive including e-cigarettes as part of policies that are happening across the state that previously were just around combustible cigarettes. And so that's an example of how these data plug right into efforts to intervene.
That's a great point, because now you got 20%, almost 20% of kids, 1 in 5, using e-cigarettes, which I know when they came out were viewed as a healthy alternative. And it seemed like every time you turned around, there's a kid with the lanyard puffing on one of those things. I mean, there was one in my building the other day puffing it inside, and it stinks. But, you know, they have this idea that it's safe because it's not combustible. But it's really not in the information. So it seems like the survey results, as you said, really help target where the funds need to go and really help identify the populations or the folks that need to be served better.
Yeah, and in Anchorage, there's a group, the Anchorage Collaborative Coalitions, which is a group of three coalitions: Spirit of Youth, Healthy Voices, Healthy Choices, and Anchorage Youth Development Coalition. And over the last year and a half, we've looked at YRBS data as well as a variety of other sources and found that in Anchorage anyway, bullying, being bullied or having engaged in bullying behavior are highly associated with suicide and all of the risk factors beneath or that come before suicide. And so we've prioritized bullying prevention for the next 2 years in Anchorage. And it won't necessarily look like a bullying prevention program. It will take in all of the factors that we've learned as a result of reviewing these data to determine how best to make a difference. And one example that's highly also associated with feeling sad or hopeless, seriously considering suicide, is youth who strongly agree that they matter to people in their community. So from that, we'll look at, so what are some ways we can help youth feel more connected to their community and that they matter? And then the next 2 years, we'll be seeing some of those programs developing or beefing up their presence in Anchorage. And hopefully then in the 2019 YRBS, we'll see some change.
That's a really great question. Do you feel like you matter to the community? Because as we all know from happiness research, happiness comes from connection, connection to other people and relationships. And so if kids feel connected to their elders or to their grandparents, and those are the protective factors that Jennifer, you were talking about earlier. So that's a really good question. The bullying thing, I guess, is that targeting? Because like I was looking at one of the trends that where it says a kid did not go to school because they felt unsafe at or on their way to or from school at least one of the past 30 days. And that number has increased from 5.5% to 8.8%. That seems almost 9% of our kids didn't feel safe at school. And schools have a zero tolerance policy for bullying, right?
Yes.
So, Jennifer, what is this bullying information telling us? What are we missing in the schools? What can we do differently? Because this is something that a lot of kids in my office show up. Anxiety disorders and depression is a direct result. You know, a lot of times the trauma is not at home. A lot of times, you know, people, this isn't always about blaming the parents. A lot of times trauma, kids don't talk about it with their parents. They don't talk about it with their teachers. They're scared. And the teachers say, or the school says, well, I don't know. I can't, you know, it's one kid's word against the other. But if 9% of kids aren't feeling safe at school, how do we shift this conversation to put more attention on it? I know there's a lot more attention, but how do we deal with this?
Well, I mean, young people have been involved in bullying prevention activities through the Lead On for Peace and Equality event, and they also do mini grants from that event and actually are able to have young people be supported in bullying prevention in schools. But along with that is policy development. Recently, I know there was at least Anchor School District, and I think it was one of the schools in the Valley published their expectations for acceptance and non-harassment of people that are transgendered. And so really understanding that, because we don't ask that in the YRBS data, but we know that young people that identify as a different gender or a lesbian, gay, bi, transgendered person may have more likelihood of being bullied, and especially in high school and, you know, or like late middle school. So I think that's another piece where the YRBS could be of benefit if we could ask, you know, more detailed questions on our identifiers, and that would help drive a little bit more of, because within 8%, it's a small, seems like such a small percentage, but really it's a large number of youth that we are missing.
Yeah, if you take a class of 30, you got almost three.
Mm-hmm.
So that's significant. So what are some of the, I guess before we go there, I'd like just remind folks, if you're just joining us late, my guests today are Marcia Howell with the Alaska Injury Prevention Center, public health scientist Andrea Fanati with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, and the Adolescent Health, or one of them, project coordinator for the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services, Jennifer Baker. Today we're discussing the results of the 2015 Youth Risk Behavior Survey and just what that means. So what are some of the trends that are exciting? I mean, we've been talking a lot about the negative things and increased depression and increase in suicide stuff and not feeling safe at school. What are some of the things that you guys at the YRBS are excited about? What are folks talking about that are in a positive light?
Well, we actually saw a lot of progress, again, over the last 8 years and some just from the last administration. Over the last 8 years, we saw significant declines in the percent of high school students who rode with a driver who had been driving under the influence. So that is, of course, really good news.
Yeah.
As well as significant declines both in current alcohol use and binge drinking. So all those numbers are going in the right direction. We're continuing to see, but over the last 8 years, a decline in tobacco use. Although, as I say, now there's another form of nicotine with these e-cigs, so that kind of changes how we assess that. But we also saw a decline in exposure to secondhand smoke. So another measure related to tobacco use that's very important for chronic disease prevention. We saw declines in the percent of students who report ever having sexual intercourse. So abstinence is going up. And as well, we track soda use, sugary drink use, and that number has been going down as well.
Energy drinks, sodas, all that stuff. Are those all lumped into one?
That's a really good question, because they one thing that messes up people like me who try to track trends is when there's a new product like e-cigs or there's a new sports drinks. Boy, we have to measure those. So we really can't measure it in exactly the same way that we have in the past. So sodas have gone down. Hooray. But as we start looking at the energy drinks and the sports drinks, that might, to some extent, cancel some of that progress out.
And cigarettes have gone down, but at the same time, e-cigs have gone up, so maybe some of those kids are just moving over.
Well, a point on that is over the long term, we've seen great progress with smoking in youth, but over the last, between 2013 and 2015, it's been flat. So we are concerned that we're stopping making progress in smoking, which we know well what the harms are of that. And now on top of that, we have sort of this, the e-cig use that we have to figure out as well.
One of my favorite statistics of all time is that 90% of adult smokers started before the age of 18. It's like, I tell that to kids every day in my office, and they're like, oh, and I'm like, you guys are suckers. Like, they're duping you. They're sucking you in. And that certainly is true. Like, I see it. And the e-cigs seem to just be another way to deliver nicotine. Somebody I had on from the American Tobacco Society, or American Cancer Society, said that they're doing a good job, the tobacco industry, of recruiting new users as the older ones die off. So that's something certainly to be aware of. So. Yeah. Trends, other trends. Is there anything? Alcohol seems to be down. I know cigarettes have been down even before cigarettes. Cigarettes doesn't seem to be cool anymore. That's something good. Any other trends that are pretty exciting?
I think we're definitely keeping an eye on marijuana use with recent legalization.
So there's
a whole idea of perception of risk of use and actual 30-day use is probably going to be some things we're definitely keeping an eye on.
It does seem to me that, like, when you look back at some of these trends that are improving, and you look back at the programs that you implemented to address them, are you seeing certain areas where your money is better spent than other areas? Like in the, on a peer counseling, or not peer counseling, but peer sort of directed programs? Are you, because I assume that would be a good way to say, why did we see this improvement? And where did we direct our funds that created this, or what are you seeing there?
I think it's hard to say, well, this program made this change through YRBS, but I think a lot of people working towards improving seatbelt use over the years has resulted in improved seatbelt use. And now we can focus a little bit less on that and move towards cell phone use or distracted driving, or I think we talked a little bit with Jenny about the idea that a lot of kids in the car are going to create situations where those normal safe behaviors that a person might engage in alone, suddenly, you could say, go out the window. So as things change through YRBS, we change our own efforts to meet the needs. I think another area that we'll be looking at will be the opioid heroin issue, and that's, fairly new question, but nationally anyway, there are big changes happening there, and we're going to keep an eye on that one.
That's blowing up. Heroin's another something that a lot of focus is being put on. All right, so I do have a question from a caller that I want to read. It says, Are we teaching teens that they don't yet have the equipment, meaning their frontal lobe, to make long-term decisions? Their brains won't fully develop until they're in their mid to late 20s, so they don't have the physical hardware to make lifelong decisions yet. Are we teaching them that, oh, it's not my fault, my brain's not all the way there yet, like, I don't have the brakes?
I honestly think there are many people who are working on this, and I can think of one example in particular of a positive youth development focused group, which is the Kachemak Bay Family Planning Clinic and the Rec Room. And they specifically do peer education in schools with an adult component and are really focused on other things as well, not just sexual health education, but body regulation, emotion regulation, being able to, noticing when your amygdala is getting tickled and be able to recognize what is happening as far as emotion is concerned, and being able to really stop and think about what that emotion means. And then maybe not necessarily think about the consequences, but what might happen afterwards. So I think that modulation and body regulation are huge components. And even being able to, like, do self-care. Like, I know there's a lot of schools out there right now that are really focused on having a quiet moment in the beginning of a school day or after lunch, where you can think about body, understanding where your body is and understanding where your emotions are, and being able to take a moment and be silent, which is you know, in Eastern culture, it's about meditation, but really it's just about being able to have some mindfulness as a part of your school day.
Absolutely. I think of STOP as stop, think, action, plan, right? I'm sure people have heard that before. And I always remind kids that you are absolutely capable of making good decisions. You just need to sometimes not go with your first impulse, like, you know, like question whether that's a really good idea or not and think it through. And I find kids are super smart. And, you know, they'll tell me how all their friends should do it or how they're going to do it when they're parents. But sometimes, as you said, I think that's a great way to look at it. What were you thinking is not really what were you thinking. It's what were you feeling in that moment. It's usually I want or I need or, yeah, something like that.
Absolutely.
Okay. We got a lot more to cover, but we don't have time to do it. So give me a quick, just in 20, 30 seconds, what is it that you want listeners to take home or what do you want them to think about? We'll start with you, Andrea.
Well, I guess people have probably heard what gets measured gets done. And I feel like the YRBS and other surveillance systems that we rely on are so important because if we don't know what's going on, we don't know if we're being effective. We don't know how to be more effective and improve those programs. So it's a really valuable tool for us.
All right. Marcia?
Not only that, but it also, in addition to that, it brings in money. We get federal money based on successes that YRBS is showing us. And just I just want to echo what Jenny said about mindfulness and taking a moment. Really, that can help pretty much all of these issues that are on the table.
All right, thanks.
I would have to say that talking with youth every day, asking them questions, letting them know that they matter, and being patient with young people because they are a work in progress. And also just, I encourage young people to give me a call at the Adolescent Health Program and tell us what they think is important, because we can track the data and look at it. But if they really feel like there's something else that we're missing, that we're not asking the right questions, then we need to know about it.
They're very, very capable. And
absolutely.
I love the idea of empowering them to participate in the conversation.
They should be here today. And I'm sorry I couldn't make that happen.
Maybe I'll do this same thing with kids. My thanks to today's guests, Andrea Finotti, Marcia Howell, and Jennifer Baker. It was a pleasure having you on the show today. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you very much.
Please remember, you can check out the links and information we have available on today's topic by going to alaskapublic.org and clicking on the link to today's show. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can join us on Facebook. You can find that link on our website. That's alaskapublic.org. As always, feel free to share your thoughts or comments about today's show with us at our email address, line1@alaskapublic.org. All right, mosquitoes are estimated to transmit various types of disease to more than 700 million people each year, and over 1 million people annually die of these diseases. These numbers make mosquitoes the deadliest animal on the planet. On the next Line 1, Drs. Thad Woodard and Ben Wesley discuss mosquito-borne illnesses, so why not tune into your health and learn more Monday, April 4th at 2 p.m., repeating at 8 p.m. on FM 91.1 Alaska Public Media. Pat Yak is the Chief Content Officer for Alaska Public Media. Eric Bork is our web editor and audio engineer for today's show. Please remember, adolescents are wired to take risks, and risk-taking is an important part of healthy development. It's our job as their parents to nurture and guide this exploration so they avoid risks that can have severe consequences on their health and their future. Thanks for taking the time to join us today on Line 1. Until next time, I'm Prentice Pemberton. Have a great day.
Line 1 is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Learn more about Line 1 and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.